Assalamualaikum warahmatullahi wabarakatuh. This is A.B. Dauji and this is The Big Picture. Just over 3 weeks ago, the 25th of February, was the anniversary of a bloody event. It was Fajr time. It was Friday. It was Ramadan. 25th February 1994. The Al-Ibrahimi Masjid in Hebron, Palestine, was full of Musallis. In a huge Jewish settlement next to Hebron lived Dr. Baruch Goldstein, who had come to Israel from New York in 1983. In 1981, he wrote a letter that was published in the New York Times, in which he said that all the Arabs, all the Palestinians, must be decisively removed from Israel's borders, the land Israel controls, including the West Bank and the Gaza. He was a dedicated disciple of Rabbi Meir Kahan, whose views were regarded as rabidly racist. Rabbi Meir Kahane's organization was known as Kach, which was declared a terrorist organization by Israel. So Dr. Baruch Goldstein went over to Israel in 1983. He joined the Israeli Defense Force as a medical doctor and was designated as a captain in the Israeli army. Dr. Baruch Goldstein refused to treat Palestinians because he believed that non-Jews, the treating of non-Jews was against the Torah. On the morning of the 25th of February, 1994, Dr. Baruch Goldstein, wearing an army uniform, walked into the Al-Ibrahimi Masjid carrying an IMI Galil assault rifle, a machine gun, and four magazines which held 140 bullets. It was just after 5 a.m. There were 800 musallis in the masjid. As they knelt down and put their heads onto the ground in the Fajr Salah, Baruch Goldstein opened fire with his automatic weapon. The shooting lasted 2 minutes. 29 people were killed and 125 wounded, among them children. Someone picked up a fire extinguisher and threw it at him. It hit him on the head and he fell down. And then the Musallis overpowered him and beat him to death. Many in Israel were totally disgusted by this act of cold-blooded murder. But many others in Israel celebrated what Baruch Goldstein had done. Goldstein was buried in the nearby Jewish settlement of Kiryat Arba. This is from Wikipedia. It says the grave site has become a pilgrimage site for Jewish extremists. A plaque near the grave reads, "To the holy Baruch Goldstein, who gave his life for the Jewish people, the Torah, and the nation of Israel." According to Baruch Marzel, about 10,000 people had visited the grave by the year 2000. 10,000 people had visited the grave by the year 2000. While mainstream Jewish religious leaders, including the chief rabbi of Israel, rejected the suggestion that killing Palestinians was authorized by the Torah, some extremist religious Jews have defended Goldstein's actions. At Goldstein's funeral, Rabbi Yaakov Perin claimed that even 1 million Arabs are not worth a Jewish fingernail. Even 1 million Arabs are not worth a Jewish fingernail. Samuel HaCohen, a teacher at a Jerusalem college, declared Goldstein the greatest Jew alive, not in one way, but in every way. The greatest Jew alive, not in one way, but in every way, and said that he was the only one who could do it, the only one who was 100% perfect. Rabbi Dov Lior of Kiryat Arba declared that Goldstein was holier than all the martyrs of the Holocaust. In the weeks following the massacre, hundreds of Israelis traveled to Goldstein's grave to celebrate Goldstein's actions. Some Hasidim danced and sang around his grave. Some visitors declared Goldstein a saint and hero of Israel. Matityahu Alansky, a New York native, a citizen, stood outside Dr. Goldstein's yellow limestone apartment building, where he had just left a letter of condolence for the doctor's widow and children. Mr. Alansky said, "We are proud of what he did. He has given us pride as Jews. He is a hero. People may have died, but he has given life to the country. He has shown us that God is with us, that Jews will now fight back." Did you get that? Parush Goldstein is regarded as a saint by many ultra-right-wing Israelis, and there are many of them, thousands in fact, in the West Bank, who hold the same views as Parush Goldstein, and who on a daily basis harass the Palestinians. Did you hear that? On a daily basis, harass the Palestinians. Go to two websites, Ma'an, M-A-A-N, and the other one is I-M-E-M-C, I-M-E-M-C. Go and Google these two websites and you will see daily reports of these ultra-right-wing racist settlers attacking Palestinians, destroying thousands of Palestinian olive trees, harassing Palestinian schoolchildren. It's a horror story. And I'm saying it happens almost every single day. Bottom line is that there are hundreds, if not thousands, of Parush Goldsteins in Israel who believe that Palestinians should be deported from all of what was original Palestine and now under total Israeli control. That, as I told you, was the policy of Kach, the Kach party of Rabbi Meir Kahan. His party briefly took part in elections in Israel and was then banned in October 1988 because of its racist ideology. Well, listen to this. That racist ideology of Rabbi Meir Kahan has come back in the form of a party called Jewish Power, or in Hebrew, Otzma Yehudit. The news website, the Jewish Telegraphic Agency, describes this party as the spiritual godchild of Rabbi Meir Kahan. Of Meir Kahane's Kach party. Okay, are you still with me? Great. Alhamdulillah. So, why am I telling you all this? Because we are getting to the interesting part, what I call the meat and potatoes. Elections are due to take place in Israel next month. There isn't one big single party that can take power by itself. Like the ANC here, for example. It's a big party, it can take power by itself, but not in Israel. There are a whole lot of small parties, and therefore, to become the government, small parties have to join together in what is known as a coalition. Netanyahu's party, known as Likud, has ruled Israel by forming these alliances, this coalition with a few small parties. So, where are we now before the April 9th elections in Israel? Shocking news, dear listeners, shocking news. Netanyahu has made a deal with the party known as Jewish Power and promised them two cabinet seats if he wins, if this coalition wins, if they get the majority of the votes combined. Let me remind you again, and this is from the article of the Jewish Telegraph Agency news website. It says, like its Kahanist ancestors, the party calls for a greater Israel from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean Sea, as well as the annexation of the West Bank. It calls for unrestrained settlement building and the resettlement of Palestinians and Arab Israelis in Arab countries. All the Palestinians between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea have to be sent off to settle in other Arab countries. It wants to restore Israel's sovereignty to the Temple Mount, which we call Al-Aqsa. And it seeks to cancel the Oslo Accords. This way, the so-called peace deal signed in 1993 between the Palestinians and the Israelis. The party head, Michael Ben-Ari, has called Kahan his rabbi and his teacher. Other leaders, including former Kahan aide Baruch Mazel, a resident of Hebron, who holds a party every year at the grave of Baruch Goldstein, Rabbi Benzion Gopstein, who runs Lehava, a group that opposes marriages between Jews and non-Jews, and Itmar Ben Gavir, an attorney who defends right-wing activists accused of Jewish terrorism. So there you are. This is the new party based on Kahanist ideology. Did you get that part of Jewish Powers, the Jewish Power Party's manifesto, that all Palestinians must be booted out and settled in surrounding Arab countries? And in order to show how much he likes these ultra-right-wing racist parties, Netanyahu said a few weeks ago that Israel is the land of the Jews. Israel is the land of the Jews only. Hello? Hello? What about the 20% of Palestinians who are citizens of Israel? Well, effectively, they are now regarded by Netanyahu as second-class citizens. And to show further how much he supports Jewish Power Party, how much he supports their views, he not only said that Israel is not a country of all its citizens, only the Jews, but he said the Arabs, meaning the Palestinians, these are his actual words, the Arabs have 22 nation states around them and they do not need another. The Palestinians have 22 nation states around them and they do not need another. Did you get that? Did you get that? Loud and clear. No state for the Palestinians within the area controlled by Israel, meaning the West Bank. So, basically, what he has done very decisively is that he has put a final big nail in the coffin of the idea of a two-state solution. And still people mention it. We have our government here saying that they are pushing for a two-state solution, they support a two-state solution, and so on and so on. There's no such thing. It's a myth. Netanyahu said it clearly. Go to the surrounding Arab countries and go and form your states there. Go and live with them. You've got 22 Arab states. And we all know that the two-state solution was proposed in the peace deal signed by Israel and Yasser Arafat in 1993. The Palestinians were told, give up your armed struggle and come back from exile in Tunisia and let's talk about how you can have your own state. And you know what, listeners? I told you many times that it was just a big joke, a scam, a fraud, a ruse, a setup. Imagine if the ANC was told, hey, come back from exile, give up your arms, come back from Lusaka and other places where you are in exile, give up your arms, struggle, and let's talk about a new democratic South Africa. Welcome back, this is The Big Picture, and I think I was talking to myself for a couple of minutes there while we went off air, some gremlin in the system. So let me recap. I think I left you when I said that imagine, let's see, imagine if I told you that the ANC was, imagine if the ANC was told to come back from exile, from Lusaka and other places, and give up the armed struggle. And, let's talk about a new democratic South Africa. And when Nelson Mandela was released and his comrades came back and the talks began and they went on and on and on and on for 25 years. And at the end, the ANC was told, hey, you Africans have 54 other African countries in Africa, so foot sack from here and go there, because this is under white control. What would be the response of the world? But in Israel, racist statements against Palestinians is not very shocking. Now the Prime Minister himself is giving full support to a party that is out and out racist, giving support to all the Baruch Goldsteins that are harassing the Palestinians every day. We are talking about racists. They are now given complete respectability, acceptability. It's normal to have a racist party. Nothing wrong, nothing shocking. And so, the big picture. You know, for a long time now, the racists on the world's stage have steadily emerged and become stronger and stronger. In fact, they have now taken center stage. Who are they? They are described as ultra-nationalist white supremacists. Ultra-nationalist white supremacists, meaning that they believe that the whites are superior and whites should dominate the Western world. That is, putting it very simply, much more explanation about that. White racists. So what kind of influence do they have? Big time, Mamu, big time. Right, the right-wing political parties are poised to take control of many European countries. they are openly racist parties, and of course anti-Muslim parties. Here's a headline from the highly respected website known as Foreign Policy. Foreign Policy. The choice is right or far right. That means when you are voting. As left-wing parties have collapsed, the sole option remaining for voters is conservatism or right-wing populism. The recent election in Hungary, in which the winners were two right-wing parties, is merely the latest example. The right versus populist right division is also present in Poland, the Czech Republic, Austria, Spain, and the Netherlands, and it is currently threatening to become the norm in the most important democracies in the European Union, Italy, France, and Germany. Here's another headline. The far right aims to take control of the European Union next year. And this was written in 2018. So my dear listeners, the message is clear. Right-wing views, racist views, anti-Muslim views are now mainstream. Meaning that no one is shy about being racist anymore. These views are openly expressed and openly supported by voters. That's what's happening in Europe. What about the good old US of A? Well, anti-Muslim sentiments, anti-Muslim views have gone mainstream there also. And it was mainstream a long, long time ago. After 9/11, they went into overdrive. Hate speech against Muslims was regarded as normal. The Islamophobic industry in the United States has a very respectable place in American society. Go and read the views of Pamela Geller and Frank Gaffney and so many others who regularly appear on public platforms, on TV, are quoted in newspapers, and they address the security establishment, the police force all over the country, the intelligence agencies, and so on. Go and Google it. Islamophobia in America. Shocking statements against Muslims. Muslims are a danger to society, Muslims should be deported, and so on. But what was the big win recently for the ultra-right-wing white supremacists? In one word, to describe all of that, what was a big win for the racists? What was the biggest victory? And the answer is Donald Trump. Good heavens. When he was on the campaign trail to become president, he made some really terrible statements about Muslims. And when he walked into the White House, his first big announcement was that he is banning the entry of Muslims into the United States from certain Muslim countries. And what was his explanation? A pretty stupid one, where he says, until we know what's happening. I wonder what's happening in his head. Can you imagine giving a justification? We're going to ban Muslims from Muslim-majority countries from coming into the United States until we know what's happening. The white racists loved it. He was the blue-eyed boy. They got him elected as president, and he was delivering. So there you are. Anti-Muslim bigotry, racism, has become mainstream and given a boost by Donald Trump. And so again, to the big picture. This anti-Muslim rhetoric, propaganda, has poisoned the minds of many. It's called demonization. Make Muslims seem like they are demons, evildoers, to quote George Bush.
I think we are online again. The mic went dead. let me just recap. It's becoming a habit now. Well, they got Donald Trump elected. That's a right wing. And therefore, anti-Muslim bigotry, racism has become mainstream and given a boost by Donald Trump. And so again to the big picture. This anti-Muslim rhetoric, propaganda, has poisoned the minds of many. It's called demonization. You make Muslims seem like they are demons, they are evildoers. And as I said, to quote George Bush, demons, devils, satanic, that's the kind of impression that is put out by these races. And so, what do you do with demons? Very simple, you eliminate them. Halas, easy. And so there are many who are fed this undiluted poison. And it goes to their heads. And they feel obligated, some of them who are getting this poison, they feel obligated to act to get rid of the demons. Let me get my AK-47 and go after these evil Muslims. And so, dear listeners, the result is dead Muslims. So who is to blame? Obviously, the shooter, the killer, the terrorist. But the bigger responsibility falls on the heads of those who manufacture and distribute this anti-Muslim poison, the racists. Do you remember Baron Stradom, known as Witwolf, who killed 7 black people on 15 November 1988? He was brought up on a diet of hatred of blacks. And once upon a time, the AWB was allowed to express its racist views openly. That was the political climate at that time, during apartheid. Now, if you said the same things, you would be having tea, brown bread, and thick jam with penny sparrow. But then, at that time, it was fine. Just as anti-Muslim racism is fine, is acceptable in the United States and Europe at this time. But here's something I picked up over the past 2 days, which gives a slight glimmer of hope that the tide, inshallah, is turning. That maybe things will change. On all the TV news programs, CNN, BBC, Al Jazeera, on all the channels, social and political commentators all said almost the same thing. That the focus has always been mainly on the radical, so-called radical, and of course they are radical Muslims, but hardly ever on radical white racists. Wow. That was a big observation. All of them said the same thing. I must confess that I was quite amazed to hear this. So, the question is, could things change? Could the law enforcement agencies now turn their attention to these radical white supremacist groups who spew hate against Muslims? Hate that inspires killers like the ones in New Zealand. Here's an article I came across today. Let me read just a part of it for you. New Zealand mosque attacks fueled by white supremacist legacy. Analysts say politicians and media in Australia and New Zealand must also acknowledge the role in peddling Islamophobic hatred. Australia and New Zealand's legacy of white supremacy coupled with an unchecked Islamophobic political and media landscape were contributing factors to Friday's attack on 2 mosques in Christchurch. New Zealander Sahar Gumkor, an academic based in Melbourne, Australia, who specializes in Islamophobia, said, that media and politicians in New Zealand and Australia must take some responsibility for the way they have presented Islam to the public. She said, "Today's massacre reveals the utter irresponsibility of media and politicians who, we must acknowledge, have had a role to play in the way people have come to perceive Muslims and Islam." Gumkor said that authorities had ignored calls to tackle growing Islamophobia, even though studies are consistently showing an increasing hostile sentiment by the public towards Muslims and linking media coverage to informing these sentiments. Actually, dear listeners, these sentiments sum up what's been happening in the United States and Europe. Let me give you a final big picture observation. The majority of Muslims have strongly condemned and distanced themselves from extremist Muslims, radical ones. And yes, we must admit that there are these types amongst us. That is why, while a small number went over to join ISIS, and some of them didn't go but supported ISIS, the vast majority said that they don't represent Islam. But in the West, the extremists have been given a platform, as I said, have been given respectability, have been admired and even elected to arguably the most powerful political position in the world. And I'm speaking of Donald Trump, President Jangli. Modi is shown huge respect wherever he goes. So in this topsy-turvy world, the Muslims are painted as evil, while the racists are regarded as angels. And so in the good old US of A, we can say stupid things against Muslims. A Fox News presenter, a show host by the name of Jeanine Pirro, said this on air on March 9th, last week. She says, Ilhan Omar wears a hijab which, according to the Quran, 33:59, tells women to cover so they won't get molested. Is her adherence to this Islamic doctrine indicative of her adherence to Sharia law, which in itself is antithetical to the United States Constitution? Did you hear that? Ilhan Omar wears a scarf, so that means that she regards Sharia law above the U.S. Constitution. So by implication, therefore, she should be sacked from her job that she holds, which requires her to uphold the U.S. Constitution. Of course, all of you listeners of the big picture are very well informed and know who is Ilhan Omar and what political position she holds. But just in case you forgot, let me refresh your memory. Please follow carefully, because this is a very big story in the United States and something of a hot potato for the Democratic Party. Ilhan Abdullahi Omar was born on October 4th, 1981, which makes her 38 years old, although one may mistake her youthful looks to be in her 20s. She was born in Mogadishu in Somalia. Here's some background information. In 1995, Omar's family's application to resettle as refugees in the United States was approved, and they initially settled in Arlington, Virginia. Later that year, they moved to Minneapolis, where she learned English. Her father worked initially as a taxi driver, later as a postal office worker. He and Omar's grandfather emphasized during her upbringing the importance of democracy, and she accompanied her grandfather to caucus meeting, political meetings, at the age of 14, serving as an interpreter. Omar became a U.S. citizen in 2000 when she was 17 years old. She has spoken about her about being bullied for wearing a hijab during her time in Virginia, recalling classmates sticking gum on it, on a scarf, pushing her downstairs and jumping her when changing for gym classes. Umar remembers her father's reaction to these incidents. The father told her, they are doing something to you because they feel threatened in some way by your existence. Let me fast forward, we're running out of time. Minneapolis has a huge Muslim community. In 2016, she was elected to, Minnesota State Legislative Assembly, like your provincial council that we have here in KZN and so on. So she was elected there on a Democratic Party ticket. In the August elections last year, she won a seat in the United States Congress. Wow. With a 78% vote, she got 78%, that's magic. The Democratic Party was very happy having a woman. There you have a woman, a black woman, a Somali, a Muslim getting elected to the highest body in the United States Congress. It was a huge victory. Huge victory. Now, here is the question. Find out who you cannot criticize in the United States and you will learn who has the power. Find out who you cannot criticize in the United States and you will learn who has the power. The question was raised on a panel discussion on a right-wing Christian channel. I will play the recording after the 12 p.m. After 12 p.m., which is part two of the Big Picture on Radio Al-Ansar. You can audio stream it on your cell phone. Just type in the word Al-Ansar in Google and voila, you can hear it all the way up in Johannesburg or any part of the country. So yes, you can criticize the very powerful pressure groups like the lobby group known as the NRA, the National Rifle Association, very powerful. They don't want gun control in America. You can criticize the pharmaceutical lobby, no problem. You can criticize, actually anyone, any organization, except one, the very powerful pro-Israel lobby known as AIPAC, the American Israeli Public Affairs Committee. It has 100,000 members, 17 regional offices all over America, and a huge pool of donors. Falus. It is regarded as an agent of the Israeli government. In a week's time, that is on the 24th of March, it will be holding its annual conference in Washington. 18,000 people are expected to attend this conference, including all the top U.S. politicians. If AIPAC is happy with you, you will have a good political career, no problems. If not, you could be out. This is well set out in a book by ex-Congressman Paul Finlay in his book called They Dare to Speak Out. He criticized Israel and he was out. Cynthia McKinney, you must remember that name, a black congresswoman, did the same, criticized Israel, and she lost to a candidate supported by the lobby. Two top professors, John Mearsheimer and Stephen Walt, wrote a brilliant bestseller book called The Israeli Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy. So the thing is this, dear listeners, everyone knows about it. It's an open secret that the pro-Israel lobbies, especially AIPAC, have a stranglehold on U.S. foreign policy regarding the Middle East. If AIPAC approves of a congressman, then pro-Israeli supporters pour big money into your campaign funding. Big money. But you cannot speak about all this in the United States. You cannot say that they are funding the politicians. So we have the new kid on the block, Ilhan Omar, who threw caution to the winds and said that the lobby, AIPAC, has a stranglehold on members of U.S. of the U.S. Congress. When asked to explain how this is done, she replied, "It's all about the Benjamins. It's all about the Benjamins, baby." And these words are from the famous singer Puff Daddy's 1997 gangster rap song. Well, there you are, some bit of new useless information. Anyway, what she meant was the $100, when she spoke about the Benjamin, the $100 note which has the photograph of U.S. President Benjamin Franklin since 1914. So, she meant that money is given to congressmen to stop them from criticizing Israel, and in fact, they have to show support for Israel. Wow, that really created an earthquake. The Republican Party said she is anti-Semitic, meaning anti-Jew. Well, which is quite silly. To say that an organization in the U.S. Blocks criticism of Israel makes you anti-Jewish? That is moronic. But the Republican Party went after her with guns blazing, and even Pagla Trump said she must be booted out of the Congress. But our very feisty Ilhan went further. She said that it is unacceptable that top politicians should have dual loyalty, meaning that they have U.S. and Israeli passports, Israeli citizenship. How can that be, she asked. So these two big, powerful truths that she spoke. In fact, her own Democratic Party didn't know what to do with this outspoken truth teller. So they passed a resolution saying that the party condemns anti-Semitism. But they didn't name her, because if they did name her, the Democratic Party will be condemned for shutting down the truth about the lobby and dual citizenship. So as I said, it's a hot potato, big debate in the United States, and many, including Jewish people, have come out in strong support of her. Watch this brave lady. She's going to go places. Some say that Ilhan Omar's speaking the big truth about the lobby has split the Democratic Party. As they say, the genie is out of the bottle, the can of worms is open. Suddenly more and more people are realizing that AIPAC has captured the state with regard to U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East. Wonderful stuff. Follow that story. And now, quickly, light at the end of the tunnel. Last week in Isipingo, some chaps hijacked a big truck of human hair that is used to make wigs. And police spokesperson Kuas Vermak, he said, the latest is that police are combing the area, eh? Also in Isipingo, another police report is that some hijackers made off with a stolen car, and the stolen car crashed into a truck carrying a load of concrete. The whole load fell onto them. Police spokesperson Kuas Vermak said, police are looking for hardened criminals, eh? This is Abi Dawji, bidding you all, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.